Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In the midst of the bloody Civil War, one Ohio family, the Ewings of Lancaster, stood at the center of the Northern debate over emancipation. Thomas Ewing and his three sons were heavily involved in defending the soul of the Republican Party at the time and waging war on the South. But have you ever heard of them? This hour, we consider the saga of this dynasty during that pivotal period in history with historian Ken Heineman. Ken teaches history at Angelo State University in Texas, where he specializes in American political and social history. We're talking about his latest book. It's called Civil War Dynasty, The Ewing Family of Ohio. Ken's speaking to us from San Angelo, Texas. Welcome to the program, Ken.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the invitation.
To our listeners, we'd like to hear from Lancaster, Ohio natives and residents. How much do you know about the Ewing family? Give us a call and tell us what you know, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Ken, before the show, we were talking about a book signing you did in Lancaster recently and that you met some descendants of the Ewings, and you said they really had the Ewing DNA. Can you tell us what you mean by the Ewing DNA?
In intelligence and outgoingness, and I thought it was funny. One gentleman in particular was saying, "Well, you know, I'm a paleontologist, you know, not a politician." And it's like, "Well, you know, Thomas Ewing Sr. was often referred to as a fossil wig." So, you know, there's a lot of continuity there. But actually, the family dynasty was very logical, highly focused. So. You can always tell. Plus, the family features are quite clearly stamped there. Scots, Irish, Presbyterian, Irish, Catholic, all the way.
I'd see some good-looking men and women.
Yep.
Definitely. What first endeared you to the Ewing family, according to your acknowledgments, your interest? May have started with a fake beard and wool outfit?
Yes, it did. The Fairfield Heritage Association was doing a commemoration up at the old Ohio State Fairgrounds for Sherman's War is Hell speech. That was given years after the war had ended, and there were probably about 70 people who were asked to do reenactments, and we had a couple hundred more people who just came for the dinner. And so I was asked to do Hugh Ewing, which was a real challenge.
One of his sons.
Yes, General Hugh Ewing, ambassador to The Hague, you know, at South Mountain, Antietam, Vicksburg, Missionary Ridge, and a novelist after the war. But no resemblance whatsoever.
And from there, you realized that not very many people knew about them, and you became curious. What was that connection?
Well, I always loved hanging out at Four Reasons Bakery Coffee Shop in downtown Lancaster, and the people who own the bakery also own the Thomas Ewing Mansion, which is up on Main Hill. And I would sit in Four Reasons staring out across the street at this two-story tall mural of William T. Sherman with basically Atlanta burning in the background and this maniacal look in his eyes. And it was a curiosity about the family that adopted him. And, of course, he married Ellen Ewing. And there was one point that always never made sense to me, because it always be mentioned in the passing in the Sherman biographies that, you know, Sherman was married at the Blair House in 1850, which the Ewing family was renting. And
this, of course, is in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, and it's the vice president's residence. So, yeah, the Ewings just happened to rent the house that becomes, you know, where we, you know, the Blair House. And there's the entire U.S. Supreme Court attends the wedding, President Zachary Taylor, all the cabinet, and Thomas Ewing at that time was Secretary of Interior. And it just never made sense to me, why would all these folks come out to see a junior army officer like Sherman get married? And it's like, no, they're there because of the father-in-law, because of Thomas Ewing Sr.
He was known as the father of generals for the careers of his three sons, right?
Yes.
Could you tell
Sherman.
Us about that?
Sure. You know, Lancaster was a community in Fairfield County. I mean, we're talking only about maybe 4,000 people in Lancaster at the time of the Civil War, and that community produced, I think, ultimately six Union generals, but overwhelmingly voted against Lincoln every time. So, you know, it's always found that fascinating. Thomas Ewing Jr. Fought the guerrilla insurgency in the Kansas-Missouri borderlands and issued General Order No. 11, which led to the deportation of 10,000 people who were suspected of aiding the guerrilla insurgency of William Quantrill, and then became a policy advisor to President Andrew Johnson. And he also defended Samuel Mudd at the conspiracy trial for the murder of Abraham Lincoln. You know, he kept busy. And then there's Hugh Ewing, who enlists as a colonel for the liberation of Western Virginia in 1861, when Ohio and Indiana went in to free the West Virginians from the Richmond oppressors. And Hugh Ewing distinguished himself at South Mountain on the road to Antietam in 1862, became a general, served with distinction at Vicksburg. Basically, Hugh Ewing's troops at Vicksburg at one point may have been about 6% of the Union troops there during the siege. They received 24% of the Medal of Honors awarded. They were in the thick of the action in the initial run under the guns of Vicksburg, and then a horrible volunteer force of 150 men led by Hugh Ewing on an assault on a Confederate position at Vicksburg, and then Missionary Ridge. And then little Charlie Ewing, the scamp, served in the 13th U.S. Infantry, was transferred to his brother-in-law's command to Sherman to fight at Vicksburg, had a finger shot off in an attack on a Confederate position, then participated in the siege of Atlanta and marched through Georgia as kind of the logistical whiz, making sure all the troops were fed, making sure no one got lost, and also kind of acting as judge advocate general to make sure that what they were destroying and burning was actually generally okay to burn and destroy. And he ended the war. Charlie Ewing ended the war as a general, of course, as did Hugh and Tom. And then when you add Sherman, it's Thomas Ewing Sr., father of generals.
Quite a distinction. My guest is Ken Heineman. He teaches history at Angelo State University in Texas. We're talking about his new book. It's called Civil War Dynasty, The Ewing Family of Ohio. If you have a question or comment for Ken, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Or you can check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Let's talk about the foster relationship. General William T. Sherman was a foster son of Tom Ewing. How did that happen? What was the relationship between him and the Ewing family? How did they come to adopt him that way?
Well, it goes back to Sherman's father, Judge Charles Sherman. And the story goes back to the Kanawha Valley of Virginia, where Thomas Ewing Sr. was boiling salt for 6 years and then going back and forth to an academic academy in Athens, Ohio. And Ewing taught himself French in between boiling salt. And when he took his exit exam to become the first graduate of what is now Ohio University, mm-hmm. one of the members of the trustees who examined him was Charles Sherman. And it was Charles Sherman who told Thomas Ewing, you know, you're a bright, energetic man. You stand over 6 feet tall, 260 pounds. You're imposing for sure. Why don't you come up to Lancaster and see about reading law, becoming an attorney? And Ewing says, certainly, I'd be happy to do that. And he interviews with Philemon Beecher, who had been a member of Congress. And Beecher just couldn't believe this man who walks in. He looks like he could thrash everyone at the Red Lion Tavern in Chillicothe. This big rustic comes in, and then he's just struck by the earnestness because he says, well, Beecher asks Ewing, have you read Blackstone's legal commentaries, the four volumes? You know, are you familiar with this work? And Ewing says, oh, yeah, I read him last month and memorized him.
Yeah, he was more than just highly intelligent. He was probably like almost a prodigy, wasn't he?
Exactly. Thomas Ewing and Judge Charles Sherman hit it off well. They worked together as defense attorneys around Ohio, riding the old court circuit. And when Judge Sherman died, he had left debts, numerous children, and the children ended up getting farmed out. So the Ewing family took in William T. Sherman. John Sherman stayed a while with his mother, but he was such a reckless basically juvenile delinquent, that John Sherman ends up getting shipped off with family members in northern Ohio, and later, of course, becomes United States Senator John Sherman.
Richard in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah, who's this?
Richard, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, my question is this. This is very interesting, and I was wondering if the Ewing family of Texas, which the TV series is concerning, are they in relation to the Ewings of Ohio and the immediate family of the Ewings that we're talking about down in Lancaster?
Well, the not really. I mean, the Ewing name is the Scots-Irish. That's a name out of Ulster, which is where the Ewing family originated, as poor Scots-Irish Presbyterians who settled Northern Ireland, Belfast, in the early 1600s, and then basically fled as refugees to the American colonies. So in that sense, you know, Dallas, recognizing the Ewings that way is a continuity that the Scots-Irish are these fighters, these frontiers people, you know, with musket and tomahawk in hand, they went out into the wilderness. So that's really what that's playing on, is the tribe, that Scots-Irish tribe.
Thank you, Richard, for that call. The title of your work is Civil War Dynasty, and a dynasty conjures images of something maybe not quite American. Why did you decide, although we just finished, you know, you just finished right. talking about a fictional dynasty, I guess.
Yeah.
Why did you decide on using that term to define the Ewings?
It was because of the family relationships. I think a lot of the history, especially the biographies of Sherman, never laid out the interconnections. For example, the Ewing family is related by marriage to Henry Stanberry. Henry Stanberry was also a law partner of Thomas Ewing Sr. Henry Stanberry became Andrew Johnson's attorney general and defended Johnson at a Senate impeachment trial. One of the other cousins is James Gillespie Blaine, who became the Republican Speaker of the House and the 1884 Republican presidential candidate. And James Gillespie Blaine, Cousin Jimmy, used to spend summers and went to school in Lancaster with his Ewing cousins. So basically, as I started to realize, wow, all of these people are cousins. This is a dynasty. This is a family that rose through its family relations, its intelligence, its drive, that also took care of each other. Thomas Ewing Sr. was very solicitous towards his children, wanted to give them every opportunity, but constantly challenged them to become better educated and to live up to a creed. And their mother, Maria Boyle Ewing, tried to make sure they were good Catholics.
Which is another story that we'll get to
yes.
when we return to our conversation with Ken Heineman. He's author of Civil War Dynasty, The Ewing Family of Ohio. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
The Oscar-nominated film Zero Dark Thirty opens with a declaration that the story is based on firsthand accounts of actual events. But lawmakers like Senator Dianne Feinstein take issue with the film's depictions of torture and want the film branded as fiction. I'm Celeste Headlee. The shifting opinions on what's torture and what's not. Next, Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 to 4 on 89.7 NPR News. 25 degrees with cloudy skies, reaching a high of 33 today. There is a chance of some light snow tonight, a low of 21, mostly sunny and a high of 31 for Wednesday. Support comes from the Columbus Jazz Orchestra, performing with the Columbus Youth Jazz Orchestra in Ragtime Blues and Beyond, A Short History of Jazz, with guest saxophonist Tia Fuller and drummer Lewis Nash, showcasing over 100 years of jazz, February 7th through the 10th at the Southern Theater. Details at jazzartsgroup.org. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. My guest is Kenneth Heineman. He is the author of a new book. It's called Civil War Dynasty, The Ewing Family of Ohio. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Ken, we stopped it at the issue of Catholicism. Religion was a big part of the family's life by virtue of Thomas Ewing's wife, Maria. To what extent did the Catholicism of the Ewings affect their politics? And I suppose you could maybe start that off with something related, the idea of how unusual it was that there was a blended family like this at the time, at least a blended family of such prominence.
Exactly, because the Ewings and the Boyles, Maria Boyle Ewing, their ancestors fought on opposite sides of the sectarian wars of Northern Ireland, opposite sides in the Siege of Londonderry, the Battle of the Boyne in 1690. But when they came to America, unlike a lot of their countrymen, they realized that, you know, to Ewing, Belfast in Northern Ireland was the Scots-Irish Troy, and America would be their Rome. And, you know, that's why he loved the Aeneid, Virgil's Aeneid, when he discovered it as a small child and wanted to learn Latin. And so if you're going to build an empire, if America is the new Rome, if Ohio is the center of a new civilization, one cannot afford to be religiously divided. You know, we are one people. And also Thomas Ewing Sr. was not sectarian. He was far too intellectual for that. So he figured that Maria Boyle, being a devout Catholic, should be the one who teaches the children values. And a lot of her values, especially the injunction, do unto me as you would the least of my people, is certainly what shaped the attitude of Hugh Ewing and Charlie Ewing, most especially, that you have a responsibility to all people and to treat all people with respect, whether they're Mexican ranchers, whether they're Southern slaves, that everybody's entitled to some level of human consideration. And that very much shaped the brothers, especially Hugh and Charlie's attitudes towards the war.
The issue about the war and Hugh and Charlie were different from their other brother yep. and their father, right?
Yes. Thomas Ewing Sr. was willing to live with slavery in the South so long as it did not go to the Western territories. When he entered the U.S. Senate from Ohio in the 1830s, he had always taken that point when he butted heads with South Carolina Senator John C. Calhoun. Tom Ewing Jr. Was all about making profit. He wanted to build his own empire in Kansas before the war in the 1850s. Tom was Ewing Jr. was not an advocate of social equality. He believed that slavery was an economic, that was the problem. It was economically inefficient. Tom Ewing Jr. would recruit black troops because in the guerrilla insurgency in Missouri, you could only trust the black troops not to take the guns the U.S. government gave them and then turn it on them, which they had a problem with that in Missouri. Hugh and Charlie, they just oppose slavery. They see that it's wrong. And especially Hugh, he was always wore his emotions on his sleeve.
Steve in Newark, you're on the air with Ken Heineman. Welcome, Steve.
Good morning. Just wanted to ask your guest about what his opinion is regarding the social attitudes Sherman had at the time of the Civil War. Even though he was a Union general and fought for the preservation of the Union and the abolishment of slavery, well, not initially, but eventually, the abolishment of slavery was what the war was about. He has a kind of a legacy of being not particularly sympathetic to the cause of the African Americans at that time. There's some of his writings that point to that, as well as actions like during his march in Georgia,
right.
Ebenezer Creek, those events, that type of thing. What extent do you think, you touched on it just now a little bit, Thomas Ewing's political leanings and beliefs around that colored, let me back up, use another word, affected Sherman's, what most people consider kind of kind of dissonant with his goal of fighting the South.
Right.
Those attitudes came from Tom Yoon. I'll take my answer off the air.
All righty, Steve. Yep. Thank you.
Sure. Yep. Well, if you look at the correspondence among the family, Sherman was the only one who was prone to use a term of derision for African-Americans. The Ewing boys, and even Thomas Ewing Sr., never used the word that I'm referring to. Never. And I always found that rather telling as I was going through the correspondence. Thomas Ewing Sr. was a, you know, he's born in the at the end of the 18th century. Certainly not an advocate of racial equality, yet when Hugh Ewing in Western Virginia started coming across runaway slaves, he was sending them to his father to find them work in Lancaster. And ironically, the year before at the Washington Peace Conference, Thomas Ewing Sr. had warned that if slaves were free, they would invade Ohio and commit all sorts of crimes. But a year later, Thomas Ewing Sr. is just going, oh, Lord, this kid. Okay, send all of the runaway slaves you can up to me. I will find them work. Just don't tell anyone that I'm doing this. That was essentially the attitude. And whereas Sherman was always contemptuous of slaves, of African Americans, when Sherman was stationed in South Carolina, Hugh had discovered some abolitionist literature, and Sherman just ridiculed young Hugh Ewing for even paying attention to that kind of nonsense. So Sherman's racial attitudes, I would not pin those on Ewing. I would pin them on the fact that it's Southern Ohio. Remember that Ohio was founded by Virginians, among them Thomas Worthington, mm-hmm. you know, governor and senator, who was a slave owner,
mm-hmm.
who brought his slaves with him to Chillicothe, which at that time, you know, was this, you know, the territorial capital. And he didn't call them slaves. They were just indentured servants who could not leave his employ. You know, and the original Ohio State Constitution forbade African-Americans from voting, sitting on juries, going to public schools. So the anti-black sentiment is stamped very much in Ohio, and especially central and southern Ohio over to the old Virginia Military Institute.
Although Ohio tends to have a strong reputation on the Underground Railroad and, you know, of course, as a union state.
Right. Well, that's at Western Reserve, that Connecticut Yankees up there along Lake Erie.
Mm-hmm.
They're really, that region of Ohio doesn't become important until after the opening of the Erie Canal in 1825. The first Ohio is that Virginia Military District around Circleville, Chillicothe.
Mm-hmm.
That's where Revolutionary War veterans from Virginia, they could get their land claims as payment for their service. That is what stamped Ohio in its beginning. And of course, you know, but here's the irony. Ohio produced over 200 Union generals and some of the most important radical politicians like Senator Ben Wade. They're all from up northern Ohio. But Ohio also produced the largest number of anti-war politicians, copperheads, mm-hmm. pro-Confederates. So there's at least two Ohios.
Thomas Ewing first encountered large numbers of African Americans when he worked extracting salt in Virginia. I thought that was an interesting story. What were his impressions at the time, and do you think that they did come to influence him later in life? Of course, the African Americans, I thought was interesting, at those salt mines were more valued than the white workers.
Exactly, because as slaves, you know, they cost money to replace, whereas the white labor force, mainly Scots-Irish Protestant, could be easily replaced, and all the workers noted it. They all observed the different treatment, and that did shape Thomas Ewing Sr. to go, well, you know, basically, if the Kanawha Valley is any indication, these slaves are better off than the other refugees of Belfast.
I was wondering how the brothers got along, how Thomas Ewing's three boys, who rose to such prominence, each of them themselves, were they close?
Very, very close. Maria Boyle Ewing, their mother insisted that the family act as a unit, that there would be no sibling rivalries, that they would help one another whenever possible. And even Ellen Ewing Sherman, she was the one outlier. She was always loyal to her mother and father, and then to her husband, and then she would put her brothers last. But she was atypical of the way the family operated. If Hugh and or Charlie or Tom could do something to help each other, they would. And they did repeatedly.
When you say she put her brothers last, how did that manifest?
Well, I think part of Ellen's problems is, you know, she loses their son, Willie, at Vicksburg to a fever. Then Sherman's march through Georgia, he's basically disappears from the face of the earth, so he's out of contact. Ellen Sherman had, a deep sense of abandonment, and her letters are very painful. And she was never the same after Willie's death. And she tended, I think, to take things out on her brothers, especially Hugh and most especially Tom. Tom Ewing buried his emotions. You know, he was very buttoned down. And Ellen could not relate to that and took his coping mechanism of dealing with the guerrilla insurgency and the Lawrence Massacre. She took that as indifference. Whereas with Hugh Ewing, by the time you get to 1863, you get past Vicksburg and Missionary Ridge, we would now recognize Hugh Ewing as having post-traumatic stress. I mean, that would be the diagnosis. He was an idealist. He was emotional. But you look at his correspondence with his wife, Henrietta. You look at his diaries, what he's trying to write. He starts shutting down. And he's unable to come to terms with all the death and destruction he's seen. And his sister Ellen doesn't understand that either.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Ken Heineman. He's the author of Civil War Dynasty, The Ewing Family of Ohio. Give us a call if you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. You refer to three civil wars in terms of Hugh, Charlie, and Tom, and Sherman. How so?
Well, there's, of course, the war within Ohio between the pro-Southern Ohio and the abolitionist Ohio. And the Ewing family, you know, geographically and politically, are trying to navigate and be the centrists, the moderates that negotiate between the anti-war Ohio and the pro-war, the pro kind of slavery and anti-slavery. So that struggle's going on. Then, of course, there's the military struggle between North and South, and that's not always a pleasant war. That's not the war of gallant knights like, you know, Gettysburg, and it's vicious. Fighting the guerrilla insurgency, which Hugh confronted in Western Virginia, in ambushes, massacres, mutilations, torture, it's a big deal. And so it's the dirty war, that insurgency that's being fought in the Kansas-Missouri borderlands. And then there's that political war, the national political war, which the Ewing family is very much at the center, which is if the North doesn't actually win any battles, we lose the war. You can lose the war at the ballot box, just as you can lose the war at a battlefield. And that's something that Thomas Ewing Sr. understood very clearly.
You said that Hugh Ewing's war would have been familiar to the American soldiers and Marines who fought Japan in World War II, and I guess it was this guerrilla warfare?
Yeah. Well, you know, on South Mountain, wounded Confederate troops pretending to surrender and then shooting the Yankees who come to help, the Ohioans who come to help them. That's part of it. It's the take-no-prisoners attitude, which the 23rd Ohio Volunteer Infantry, led by Colonel Rutherford Hayes, which also includes Private William McKinley, the only regiment in U.S. history with two future U.S. presidents. By the end of 1861, going into 1862, the 23rd Ohio was part of the Kanawha Division, and Hugh Ewing commanded the 30th Ohio, led by future Ohio Governor Cox. 23rd Ohio's just torch farmhouses. They shoot suspected guerrillas. There's no prisoners. You don't want to be taken by the 23rd Ohio. Just plain and simple.
Why do you think that we don't hear about a lot of these aspects of the Civil War in, you know, just the general discussions, the depictions of it as a rule. It's the most deadly war ever for Americans, and everybody knows that. But we don't hear about necessarily these kinds of things.
Right. Well, you know, the estimates I've seen, historians are estimating that out of the 625,000 killed in the Civil War, 50,000 might well be due to guerrilla actions. Now, 50,000 out of 625,000 may not seem like much, but that's a Vietnam War, mm-hmm. you know, within a civil war. So I think, you know, the numbers and that has been forgotten. But I think at the end of the war, the United States is having a desperate time trying to reconcile what has happened. You know, as Lincoln said in his second inaugural address, you know, these astounding results. No one expected that the war would last this long. No one suspected that we would be trashing Georgia and the Carolinas. No one expected slavery to be abolished when the war began. And it's an awful lot to absorb. I mean, there's essentially no American family who is not affected by the war, that everyone's had a relative who fought North and South. Everyone has probably had a relative, a family member, wounded or dead. How do you come to terms with that? And talking about a dirty war of take no prisoners, of, you know, it's not a noble war. And so it becomes, I think, an imperative through this whole kind of lost cause narrative that it has to be great people like Robert E. Lee and of course, you know, and for the North, Abraham Lincoln, who wants reconciliation. You know, and I've always found that odd because Southerners don't want to bring up Jefferson Davis, you know, mm-hmm. you know, any more than you can't bring in Grant, because even Grant is bloody Ulysses Grant, mm-hmm. let alone Sherman and his tactics. I mean, very few people, Confederates, died during Sherman's march. He did something far worse. He engaged in psychological warfare and economic warfare.
By burning down their homes.
Oh, yeah, destroying cotton. And it's hard for Americans. If you want to bring North and South together, there's certain people who have to kind of disappear and or be kind of like, oh, we don't approve of those tactics. So we don't approve of Sherman. So he kind of gets shoved out, and that's why you emphasize Abraham Lincoln and that spirit of reconciliation. And so you get a civil war that really is not a realistic one. It's not one that Americans at the time would have recognized.
My guest is Ken Heineman. He is the author of the book Civil War Dynasty, The Ewing Family of Ohio. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, Michael Apted, the director of 56 Up, the eighth in a series of documentaries that has followed the lives of several British men and women every 7 years, beginning when they were 7 years old. Also, we talk with Rebecca Luker about her new album of songs by Jerome Kern. She starred in Broadway revivals of Showboat and The Sound of Music. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins later today at noon. This is 89.7 NPR News. Stay right here in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock. Hour 2 of All Sides begins, and it's Tech Tuesday with more on the China hacking story. Join us for Tech Tuesday from 11 till noon. 25 degrees with clouds and a high of 33 today. There's a chance of some snow tonight, a low of 21. Sunny skies for Wednesday with a high of 31 degrees, partly cloudy Wednesday night and a low of 20. And then a little warmer on Thursday, sunshine, a high of 44. Support comes from Mauburn Academy, a leader in college preparatory education for ADHD and dyslexic students, hosting a community parent seminar, Correcting Persistent Spelling Errors, the sources of and the solutions to the problem, February 12th at 7 p.m. More at mauburnacademy.org. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. My guest is Ken Heineman. He's the author of Civil War Dynasty, The Ewing Family of Ohio. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call at 614-292-8513. We have an email from Chris. He writes, did I hear the guest mention the name Beecher as part of the extended family? If so, is this Beecher connected to the extended family of Harriet Beecher Stowe? Her abolitionist family lived in Cincinnati before she went to Connecticut and wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin.
And the answer is yes, they are. They are kin.
Once again, another connection.
Yep. Yep. And of course, it gets kind of complicated because, oh, Lord, I'm trying to draw this out. There's a lot of kissing cousins here because not only does Philemon Beecher, Congressman Beecher, mentor Thomas Ewing Sr., he marries one of the Gillespie girls who is, the aunt of Maria Boyle Ewing. And then one of the, I think that child is the one who marries Henry Stanberry. See, that gets really complicated. I had to have a roadmap in front of me.
They were advisors to presidents. They were very important after the war.
Yes, indeed. Thomas Ewing Sr. served in the cabinets of William Henry Harrison as Treasury Secretary, Zach Taylor in Interior. Thomas Ewing Sr. also gave a lot of unsolicited advice to President Abraham Lincoln, mainly about how to avoid not going to war with Britain while we're trying to reunite the North.
Which was super important.
Very important. Lincoln and Ewing had a bad relationship. Dysfunctional might be the best way to put it.
Why is that?
Well, I think in part it goes that Thomas Ewing Jr. turned Abraham Lincoln down for a job back in 1849 for a government job that he wasn't qualified for. And that it was not a good – you read that correspondence to the Library of Congress, and it's not pleasant. Lincoln doesn't look good, frankly. He looks rather petty and demanding. And Ewing just doesn't trust Lincoln's – common sense, even though they actually have rather similar backgrounds as poor boys, self-made men and poor boys who made good. But Ewing's older than Lincoln. You know, Lincoln could be one of his sons, you know, and I we're not supposed to put historical figures on psychiatrist couches, but they're just very different individuals. Ewing Sr. was far less willing to deal with the radical Republicans, with Ben Wade. Lincoln had much more forbearance to deal with the radical wing of his own party, even though Senator Ben Wade of Ohio said Lincoln's problem was, and I quote, his poor white trash origins. Lincoln was willing to accept that and just move on. You wouldn't have done that to Thomas Ewing Sr. He would have thrashed him.
He was a follower of Alexander Hamilton and the strong central government point of view. Thomas Ewing was, and he was despised by Ohio Democrats. I was interested that he was a featured speaker for the July 4, 1825 groundbreaking for the Erie Canal. Once again, this really Walter Mitty-ish kind of guy.
Yeah, Ewing gets around. When I started this story, I was jokingly calling the Ewing family the Forrest Gumps of the Civil War.
Yeah, yeah.
And they really are because, there's that anecdote when Ewing's father, George Ewing, is always very friendly to strangers coming traveling by. But then this one man comes by asking for food and water. And George Ewing, who's a veteran of the Revolutionary War, just hands him stuff in silence. And then the stranger goes off. And then he turns to his son, Thomas, and says, you know, that was Aaron Burr. He murdered Alexander Hamilton. And it's like, oh, yeah. And of course, Aaron Burr was traveling through Ohio, up to no good, of course. And why not? Why not that the Ewing family goes to Mass in Somerset with Phil Sheridan and his family? You know, why not that the Ewings behind the back door help Phil Sheridan get into West Point? You know, when Hugh Ewing is flunked out of the academy, Phil Sheridan basically takes Hugh Ewing's place. Or, you know, why not that the kids go to Georgetown Convent School with the Mudd family? And, of course, which includes a cousin, Dr. Samuel Mudd, Yeah, you know, of course. You know, at that point, it's like, yeah, of course they know them. Of course they ran into them.
And, of course, he sat behind Daniel Webster
yep.
in Congress.
And, yep, yep. He and Daniel Webster used to exchange quips in Latin because Daniel Webster had a bad temper. So Ewing could channel him, advisor to Henry Clay in the Senate, kind of mediate the disputes between Clay and Webster. So, I mean, Ewing is not at the forefront of the national Whig leaders, but he's the guy who does the policy analysis. He does the legal reasoning. He does the political strategy. He's the behind-the-scenes guy.
And he was very much a believer that the government should provide certain things for the better yep. good of the society, Erie Canal being a good example.
Yep, the Ohio Canal, all canal construction, railroad, any type of infrastructure, education as well. Because, you know, Thomas Ewing, you know, basically our first graduate of Ohio University.
Which is another distinction.
Exactly. And so, yeah, he highly valued it, you know, that the government had a role to play in helping people use their God-given talents.
Ellen, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Ellen.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I had a question for the author. He talked a lot about people's feelings and their relationships and, you know, talking about the one individual who today may have been diagnosed with PTSD if we were to look at him today. And so I was wondering what sources he used for his research on the book, and then how long it took him to do the research and writing the book, and where his original interest in the subject matter came from.
Well, Thomas Ewing's, there's a number of collections for the Ewing family in the Library of Congress in Washington, particularly Thomas Ewing Sr.'s papers and Tom Ewing Jr. So those are there. The Ohio Historical Society has papers from Philemon Ewing, who's the oldest brother, and Hugh Ewing. There's correspondence with Ellen Ewing Sherman and William T. Sherman at Notre Dame. There's correspondence from Territorial Kansas regarding Tom Ewing Jr. So it's basically different archival sources, correspondence, and piecing these all together from Kansas and Notre Dame, from Ohio, and from the Library of Congress and the National Archives. And then one of the things I was able to do is the Ohio Historical Society has a number of regimental histories from the Civil War, including the 30th Ohio Volunteer Infantry, which Hugh Ewing commanded. So I used the diaries and letters from the soldiers in the 30th Ohio, and they go with Hugh from Antietam, to, you know, South Mountain Antietam, and then Hugh took them with him to Vicksburg and Missionary Ridge. So I was able to continue that narrative. And then the 30th Ohio ends up transferred to Atlanta in the march through Georgia. So I was able to get kind of a different view of Hugh Ewing and then of Charlie Ewing through these different soldiers' diaries and letters home in the 30th Ohio. So that helped immensely. But, you know, that was the issue. Charlie Ewing did not write a lot. He was too busy having a good time. So I had to rely on accounts of a lot of people who watched him and enjoyed him immensely. But he was not the kind to write home about what he was doing, because generally what he was doing was would not have been approved by his mother. He liked his cigars. He liked his alcohol. He liked playing pranks. He liked mimicking politicians and generals.
This was a scamp, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know, and becomes, you know, when, you know, Washington, D.C.'s most eligible bachelor. You know, he's like a you know, short Greek god among all those dark-haired Scots-Irish there. But, yeah, like I said, I just I lived in Lancaster for 18 years, taught at Ohio University in Lancaster, and, you know, they had the wonderful Sherman House there. I'd been involved in helping the Civil War Roundtable. And we had done various sponsored tours with Fairfield Heritage to Antietam and Gettysburg and to the Lincoln Museum in Springfield. So, you know, you live and breathe it for 18 years, and it's like, okay, it's time to deal with it. And, yeah, I mean, I guess I probably started the research around 2006. I started the writing around 2009. I had about half the book completed when I became department chair here in Texas. So I then spent the next year and a half, 2 years, finishing the rest of the book and then doing the rewrites.
Thank you, Ellen, for that call. If anyone else would like to give us a call, we have a few minutes left, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. So the Ewings, you talked about Charlie being the most eligible bachelor in Washington and so forth. They were very prominent. At what point in time did their star fall, or did they become less well-known? How did that happen?
Well, you never want to have on your resume helped Andrew Johnson become president of the United
okay.
States.
The impeached president.
Yeah. and, you know, they realized they had cultivated him. They had pumped him up when he came to Ohio in 1861, let him stay in the mansion. And they had no idea that he had drinking problems and an anger management issue. And, you know, several of the family had joined the Johnson administration. You know, Tom is a policy advisor. And, of course, Tom Ewing Jr. helped draft the, with Henry Stanberry, helped draft the vetoes, the presidential vetoes against the 1866 Civil Rights Act and against the Freedmen's Bureau. So the Ewings were, at least Tom Ewing Jr., who was the most political of the brothers, they did not. Ultimately, Tom Ewing Jr. rejoins the Democratic Party, but he wants them to move on from slavery and the Civil War. He opposes radical Reconstruction. They have no political home. They're trying to stand between the two parties and split the difference, and it's not viable.
So at that point, the two parties become completely separate. There's no hope ever again.
Yeah, I mean, you just can't. You're either for Reconstruction or you're against it. You're either for civil rights or you're against it. Mm-hmm. There's no middle ground there. And, you know, you take that stance. And, of course, the Democrats don't trust Tom Ewing Jr. because he issued General Order Number 11 after the Lawrence Massacre, removing 10,000 Missourians from their homes and burning their barns down, including Harry Truman's mother and grandmother among the refugees there. You know, another Forrest Gump moment here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you have that, and then you have the bloody battle of Pilot Knob in 1864 when Tom Ewing, with about maybe 900 troops, defeats a rebel army of 7,000, killing about 2,000 rebels. I mean, you know, it's like I wrote, it's like, you know, he basically killed 2,000 probable Democratic voters there that day. The Democrats don't trust him. You know, you can't, not with that. He's got his military records too good, and he defeated a guerrilla insurgency in very vicious ways. You know,
did they fade from memory prosperous?
Fairly well off. I think they got out of politics for sure. I mean, I think the last of the dynasty ends up as a U.S. patent attorney, I think, in the Woodrow Wilson administration. Mm. Yeah, but they generally, I would say they're genteel, mm-hmm. but nothing like the fortune that Thomas Ewing Sr. had amassed. You know, Ewing's law practice, I think in the 1840s, was netting something like over $1,000 a month. Hmm. You know, multiply that, 30, 40 times over? I mean, it's just incredible. I mean, before there was a K Street lobbyist, there was Thomas Ewing Sr.
Were there any, he of course was, as we mentioned earlier, brilliant, a prodigy, probably taught himself Latin as a young child. Were any of his sons close to that in terms of intellect?
Charlie.
Okay.
Good time,
the
Charlie
scamp.
Ewing.
Okay.
Oh, the scamp. Yeah, the one who seems so unfocused turns out to become an excellent, one of the nation's top patent attorneys living in Washington, D.C. He was a logistical magician in that march through Georgia, which his brother-in-law, Sherman, never really gave him credit for making sure everybody got to where they were going and had food. So, you know, Charlie Ewing had a great mind for philosophy, logic, and mathematics. And, you know, he's the one who graduates from the University of Virginia.
David in Reynoldsburg, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, David.
Thank you. I am the pastor of St. Pius X Church in Reynoldsburg, and I also am a native son of Lancaster.
Oh.
So I have a connection there. My stepmother, for a number of years, gave the tours through the Sherman home.
Oh, cool.
So I'm really fascinated by all this today on the program. A question I had was Mother Angela Gillespie,
yes,
founder of the Holy Cross Sisters, is she connected in with the Gillespies that you were mentioning earlier?
Oh, yes, and that was another, that was my, I forgot the other Forrest Gump connection. Yeah, Mother Angela, she's a cousin. And Phil Ewing marries Mother Angela's sister, Rebecca Myers Gillespie. I don't have my chart in front of me. Yeah, so that's another part of the claim. And, of course, Ellen Ewing Sherman sought solace from her cousin, Mother Angela, after Willie Sherman died. Ellen spends a lot of time at Notre Dame with her cousin, and that's partly why a big chunk of the Sherman papers end up at Notre Dame, is because of the Mother Angela connection.
Well, Ken Heineman, thank you so much for joining us today to share all of these connections. It's been fascinating.
All right. Well, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Kenneth Heineman, he is the author of Civil War Dynasty, The Ewing Family of Ohio. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.